The thesaurus, or directory, of the monastic liturgy of the hours is intended to serve as a kind of a resource book for the Benedictine Confederation. And I should say again that this is a document that is binding, and it is binding, on those who are members of Benedictine monastic communities. It is not binding on Cistercian communities, which have their own proper law that applies the principles of the Second Vatican Council to the liturgical question of the celebration of the Liturgy of the Hours. I don't have a copy of that document, and would be very grateful to take a look at it for those who might be taking the course and who could help supply it. But I provide this as an example of monastic reform and renewal, because it shows how one particular branch of the Benedictine world applied both the heritage that came from the tradition in all the different parts of the Benedictine Confederation, and that includes parts that are very enclosed and which would seldom be involved in any kind of external apostolate or work, such as the French Salem congregation founded by Abbot Guéranger, the Subiaco congregation, which is variable in expression but in general is characterized by what they call the primitive, or an attempt to be as original as possible, the early observance, the Beuronese or German congregation, which also tends not to be involved in external activities, congregation of Benedictines which are very involved in external work, such as the American Benedictines as a rule, the American Cassinese and Swiss American congregations, which have universities, as we well know, St. John's Abbey, as well as prep schools, high schools, all kinds of educational apostolates, to say nothing of the many parishes for which they've been responsible for well over a century. And the same thing is true of Benedictine women. There are congregations or confederations of Benedictine nuns and sisters, some of which are primarily or completely enclosed and do only work that requires not leaving the cloister, whereas others are very involved in the work of the apostolate. And so what we have here is an attempt to provide a vision of the Liturgy of the Hours that can be lived out by all, by the whole spectrum, by people who want to keep the office as literally as possible, using the same psalm schedule that one finds in the Rule of Saint Benedict. There are even some monastic communities, very few, but some which have attempted to go back to celebrating at exactly the same times of the day that Benedict recommends in his rule, which is difficult because Benedict lived in a time where there was a heliorhythmic definition of hours. An hour was not a particular length of a number of minutes. It was 1/12 of the division of a day or a night. And so the hours of summer and the hours of winter varied in length according to the time of year. And so to determine exactly what time an office would start is not an easy thing. It involves lots of calculations. But there are communities which do attempt to get back to something like that very ancient, if you will, kind of literal approach to celebrating the offices exactly as Benedict describes it in the rule, to communities which basically have decided that they would rather use an adapted form of the four-volume Liturgy of the Hours that is found in the broader Universal Church. So you have everything from a very traditional monastic communities to communities that want to have a much more broad, sweeping reform of the Liturgy of the Hours. And this is intended to be a document that can be read by profitably all of those within that spectrum. It's an attempt to articulate principles, and also to articulate at the end in a section that this is not in, that this does not include specific requirements, specific norms. And so let's just take a look at some of the provisions, bearing in mind that our primary goal is to look at how the tradition of the Liturgy of the Hours, its understanding, was adapted in light of what we saw in the General Instruction on the Liturgy of the Hours, which is a document that provides the background to this discussion. What you have here is an attempt to work out following the publication of the General Instruction on the Liturgy of the Hours, how monks and nuns are to revise the office in light of that reform, but also in light of their own tradition. And so there's a general, rather historical description of where this document fits in the history of liturgical documents at the very beginning, and then in part number one, a description of the eminence of the work of God, the Opus Dei, which is to say the Liturgy of the Hours, in the life of the monastic tradition, in the life of monks and nuns. So there is a statement that is very clear that the Liturgy of the Hours is a central element, is not only a, but the central element around which the life of the monastery is structured. One cannot be a Benedictine, nun, or monk without having the Liturgy of the Hours as central, the central element around which the life is structured. Then, as we see in number two, there is an ecclesial dimension. Remember the section from the General Instruction, where it's not just private sanctification, but it is the whole people of God, it is the whole church that is praying this liturgy, and in a broader sense that means that the monastery at prayer is also linked with and in communion with the whole church at prayer. The Liturgy of the Hours is a point where the local monastic community is in powerful communion with, as a part of, the whole praying church. It is, in number three, a sign of communion, and not only in this broad ecclesial sense, but also within the community itself. It has to be a priority. It's not enough for me simply to pray the hours. I have to be present to my brothers or sisters in praying the hours. I have to be there. I have to make an effort to be there. And so they cite in a particular way how important St. Benedict makes, how strongly he emphasizes the fact of physical participation in the Liturgy of the Hours, actually showing up to be there. There's an emphasis in number four of the office's dialogue with God, God speaking to us and our speaking back to God. And then, as we've described from the early tradition, an emphasis on sacred silence. The need to incorporate places of silence, but not a requirement. Again, the idea of a silence after each psalm is popular in many communities. It certainly is the practice in my own, but it is unthinkable in others, which pray the psalms in a different way, where a silent pause afterwards would seem to disrupt the flow of the prayer, and that too needs to be respected. In those communities, the sacred silence can occur after the reading in a particular way, or perhaps at some point during the intercessions. And there's a rather a powerful and important statement that that the silences are while they are there, should not bore the participants. And there it comes from the introduction or general instruction to the Liturgy of the Hours, a point that we didn't particularly highlight when we looked at it, but which is reemphasized here. Silences, although a beautiful and important and contemplative moment, require catechesis and need not to be over lengthened so that it becomes a strain on people to have too much silence during the office. So that's another point that's important to bear in mind as well. The element of music is highlighted in six. External signs are also mentioned in number seven. That is to say, all of the ritual that is essential to the celebration, standing, bowing, the manner of reciting, the particular forms in which the celebration takes in a particular community, they need to be, as it says in the second paragraph, effective signs, means of contact with a spiritual reality to which they refer, so that the monastery and the monastic celebration is not just a museum piece. In number eight, there is this difficult to translate notion, tempus validum, strong moments, valid, important, central point experiences in the monastic life of prayer. And here it's emphasized that the work of God, this communal celebration, is the strong moment of prayer, but it is also characterized by, and it's nourished by, the actual prayer of those who come to the office, their individual prayer, the prayer they do before and during and after the office. This is something that makes it strong, something that makes it valid. The idea of the difference between chronos and kairos, between time and effective time, or breaking through by God moments of time, the kairoi, is something that is also a helpful background against which we can understand the Liturgy of the Hours. They are this breaking through or breaking into by God, into our experience, which involves consecration, and which necessitates our setting aside and consecrating actual time for this. If we drop down then to number 11, there's an emphasis on the temporal cycles. The cycles throughout the Liturgy of the Hours that reflect the year as it changes. Then we find in number 12 the notion of not just the annual celebrations that are highlighted, but also the times of prayer themselves can provide a summit and source of the monastic day. They provide a rhythm of prayer, which is itself a way of living out this revitalizing, re-energizing, changing dynamic of life. It is to be, as in number 13, contemplative prayer. The Liturgy of the Hours is and should be an experience of contemplation. It isn't that I turn primarily from the office to contemplative prayer for the Benedictine, for one who follows the rule of Saint Benedict, in a very real sense. Coming to find God in, as we've seen, the Scriptures and in the Liturgy of the Hours is the place where contemplative prayer is nourished and sustained, where it happens in many ways, but it is the essential element without which real Christian contemplation is not possible. It becomes a ministry of prayer, something that the monastic community does with and for the whole church. And then there's a description in number 15 of particularly characteristic elements of monastic spirituality. An objective spirituality, that is to say, there is a real cycle of history of salvation in the liturgy. We are presented with particular mysteries, particular readings, particular cycles of both color and song and praise that we do not ourselves create, but is given to us. It is provided. It is objectively there. And that is part of our spirituality as monastics. Number two, it is a spirituality of conversation with God and contemplation, speaking to God, listening to God, realized above all in prayer, and a spirituality of communion. It is an experience of union with God and the discovery of God's love in the world and for the world. So one also finds a spirituality, each of these things being described in more detail in number 15, and now moving rather rapidly, an emphasis on the necessity to avoid empty ritualism. Rituals are vital and important, but again, the monastic celebration should not be a museum piece, simply preserving things from the past, but an opportunity for real prayer, where the tradition and experiences of the past can become legitimate, valid means by which prayer today takes place. An emphasis in number 17 on the liturgical signs being real signification. They are to be present. If you look down to the last paragraph in number 17, signs in our celebration should not be reduced. The external elements of movement, in some cases of pageantry, the use of vestments, the use of incense, all of the things that enhance Christian worship, and at the same time, the value of these signs need to be augmented by an inner awareness of what the Spirit is that animates them and what it is that they signify. The sacred assembly is particularly emphasized in number 18, the need for preparation for the community to be genuinely alert to what it is that is doing, and also to be prepared not only for each hour, but in general, for monks and nuns to be engaged, we see in the last paragraph of number 18, in a lifetime preparation through serious biblical and patristic formation. Very much what we've been discovering in this course, something that enables us to participate more vividly and truly in the Liturgy of the Hours, and a practical introduction to and capacity for celebrating the office as it's experienced in a particular community. Dropping down then to number 20, that one is both to be creative and capable of adding to and adapting, but that there are objective limits to how creative one can be. This is what rubrics are for. This is what both legislation and reflection together that provides norms for liturgy is about as well. And then we find in number 22 a very important element of the idea of the celebration being open to all. It may well be that it is primarily the monastic community and only a few guests, or maybe a large guest community, but there is a strong suggestion here that monastic prayer is something that needs to have an openness to those who come and participate in it. It is a great gift, it is a great opportunity for the whole people of God, and there needs to be an openness to receive and to welcome guests into that celebration so that it can be something that activates and animates the life of all Christians. It's rather delightful also that one finds in number 24 a strong emphasis on the particularly monastic characteristic of the celebration to be preserved, and at the same time, a rather practical discussion of the number of hours, recommendations as to how frequently the community should gather together, and that should also be characterized by, and it should take into account, the particular needs and requirements of the community itself, the apostolate or the works that the community does. That's a very balanced and good discussion, as is number 26, which describes the principal hours, emphasizes the importance of the number of times the community gathers, but also suggests the possibility of adaptations that may need to be made in communities with particular kinds of apostolates or works. And again, I'd invite you to read the rest of the document at your leisure, bearing in mind that this is simply one example of how one part of the family of monks and nuns that follows the rule of Saint Benedict applies and applied and adapted the tradition in light of the development of doctrine, in light of the renewal of the liturgy, both in the 19th century and then especially after Vatican II. And in many ways, this document of renewal and reform is still in process of being implemented, not just practically, but spiritually. It's something on which monks and nuns continue to reflectively meditate and reflect today.